Welcome to the Technori Podcast. I'm your host, Scott Catoon. Joining me on today's show, Ishan Dhaya, the co-founder of Crafty. It's been a while since I've seen him, honestly. We were at a WeWork event, and I got to sort of hear this pitch from him a couple of years ago. And where we were at the time was he was basically for companies fulfilling sort of the beer keg filler, and then he's since graduated onto food and other pieces of this, and they're just blowing up. Like they got in their own office now and looking to go to San Francisco, and it was a good conversation. If you're interested in learning how to, one, hire people on your team and want to keep them and learn how to feed everybody and make everyone happier and really do it without spending a ton of money, this is the show for you. If you also want to pick up some tips on how people, particularly young people, look at the resources and things that companies offer them and like what makes them happy, say time off versus money versus, you know, being able to make their lives more integrated. This is also the show for you. So anyway, then of course we have Fretch, which is a company that called in for a startup showcase pitch. You can invest in them by Republic. That was also a great conversation, both investor founder hat, simply because, you know, very rarely do you find a company that actually has like a fragmented marketplace that's so ginormous and no one has really taken it down yet. And this is like a teaser, $1 million in ARR and 25% of the population is your potential TAM. And like DoorDash and Instacart and all these other people have just sort of let this nice little niche there, and Fretch does it. So, you'll want to stick around for that. But before we do the interview with Ishan, got to check that startup inbox. See why 65,000 businesses use ActiveCampaign for their marketing by signing up at activecampaign.com/technori. Get the first 2 months free. What do we got here in our inbox? How to Keep a Startup Together by Ben Lancaster. My group of co-founders has been together for years and we specialize in one aspect of the business or another. However, as we grow, there's tension because we need to hire more experienced executives to help transition our business to a larger scale. How do we stay as a team without breaking up the band? That's a tough one. That really is like a tough question, and I don't know if I have even enough time to answer it, but here's the deal. In short, this is why I tell founders to be very careful about the C titles. Just because you are a lead engineer does not mean you are a CTO. Just because you are the person who posts the stuff on social and sets up some of the sales does not make you the CMO. When you start putting people in those high-level titles, there's no place to go but down. So when you come into a situation where the team needs new people, you have to demote a partner who is a C-level person in order to put the right person in place. So one of the fastest, easiest ways to do this is just go, we're co-founders, here's your role. And then every hire from there starts from the bottom up or from the middle up or down, because there's nothing worse than full steam ahead having to go back and change those names. And we've all been there, obviously, but that's the first thing. The second thing is I'm going to steal a little Howard Tolman-ism and say hire slow, fire fast. Picking your founders and co-founders and giving them the opportunity to vet in and prove themselves out to be valuable before you take it off the table is one surefire way to see who's in it to win it and who's not. But also recognizing that especially once you've taken investment dollars, that everything else goes out the window. You've got to just flat out accept the fact that if the individuals on the team are not capable of getting the job done from a company standpoint, you have other responsibilities now, and those are investors, and that is the business itself. It is not just you. You got to do the right thing for the whole company. That's why you're the CEO, if in fact that is your title. So do not be afraid to whip out that machete and axe and do some cleaning up. Unfortunately. So that's all I have to say about that. This inbox is brought to you by ActiveCampaign. Go beyond email marketing with true automation by signing up at activecampaign.com/technori and get your first 2 months for free. Next up, this is my conversation with the co-founder of Crafty, Ishan Dhaya. Ishan, it's good to have you in the studio for the first time here with me. Last time I saw you was at a WeWork, the Kinsey WeWork. We were hosting a panel. I can't remember in that one if I was hosting the panel or if I was just a member. I don't remember how that one.
You were hosting the panel. Yeah, and we were in the main atrium yep. of WeWork Kinsey, which has like the most beautiful view yeah. of the downtown city. It's awesome.
Do you remember what the topic was there? Is it small business growth or funding or something?
So I think it was about like the establishment of small businesses within the Chicago community and how startups, but organizations can be supportive of that community,
yep.
if I'm remembering it correctly.
I think, yeah, like I've done a bunch of these things, obviously, so it's like hard to remember some of it, but when you walked in, I was like, I remember this specifically. And like WeWork is so interesting to me just because of the fact that like they're everywhere now. I don't know. I don't want to get into their business model because that's a
ubiquitous.
Whole other. Yeah. But like they came in, they've come in so many different positions. Do you still office at WeWork or did you ever?
Yeah. So we office for a little bit. So we do a lot of the food and beverage and events management services for their offices,
yes.
for the locations. But we now actually have our own office in the West Loop, which
nice.
Has been the greatest. It's awesome.
So, yeah. So, I mean, this is a great segue in because like you understand the small business problem maybe better than anyone just because like feeding your employees is just like a great indicator of like growth and just like where we're
yeah.
going. Like, can we afford to feed people? Yes, no. How many people? Like, how quickly is it growing? Like, how more difficult does it get? And as someone who started off in the WeWork and then growing into it, so like, talk to me a little bit about like what Crafty is, and then let's talk more about like how you got from where you were at WeWork servicing WeWork to like servicing everybody.
Yeah, totally. So Crafty is a food, beverage, and events management service for corporate offices. So really focused around creating a benefit for folks that operate food and beverage programs within their office space
yep.
and helping them, you know, consolidate the number of vendors that they're using, automate the actual process of managing food and beverage. So everything from the stocking to automating the ordering and inventory and making sure that all of it's being managed in a really deliberate way.
Yep.
And then the third is just evolving the program as your company evolves.
Yeah.
So, you know, the program that you have as a 50-person company should look different than the program that you have as a 100-person company or a 200-person company or a 500-person company.
Yep.
And the way that it's managed should also evolve. So we've essentially created a system and a platform and an operating model to be able to adapt to the growing of companies as they establish this program within their office space. And also in a way to make sure that you're always being, one, competitive in what you're offering, not having to actually put a lot of effort into what you're doing because you've hired us on as a managed service to be able to run it for you.
Did you guys look at yourself in the, like in that culture sphere? Like, is that, I mean, obviously it's undeniable that like what you do is going to have an impact on the culture. It's interesting to me. And I don't want to, like I said, I don't want to knock on WeWork too much, but like, it was always funny to me that they aesthetically created this culture.
Yeah.
But then they weren't the ones that carried it out. And it, like, if you don't know WeWork, you're like, well, that doesn't seem like 1871 supposed to have its own culture that, you know, when Howard was there, I thought he did a very good job of harnessing and creating a culture around something that was growing really exponentially fast and was like kind of hard to rein in. But it was its own culture because it was a makeup of a certain number of people who were there for a long time, you know, respective to startup world, and then, you know, graduated in, and they came back as speakers, and then they, you know, it's like there was a natural culture. And WeWork, it's just like co-working, but like with a sexier brand, you know? And so like the culture part was lacking, and you're like, well, how can you do this? But then you realize that WeWork, like, this is early on. We didn't know WeWork was gonna like take every space in the world, basically. And so then they had to hire people like Crafty to like make it manageable. So like, how do you know, yeah. like, talk to me a little bit about the differences there, because I look at some companies like us that might not be big and could definitely use better culture, but we don't have the resources to like manage it, or I don't have that's not my creative skill set. Right?
Totally. And I think it's similar to when you're a growing organization, you always look to the professionals
yep.
in that specific thing that you're looking to solve to be able to run it.
Yeah.
And I think that is how we think about our services, right? Like, when we need really good PEO services, we don't have a fully blown HR team within our organization. Rather, what we do is we leverage shared resources that are really specialized in this area to be able to run and manage and grow this service for us.
Yep.
So we think of ourselves actually quite similar to that, where, you know, where we have organizations, we work with companies that are, you know, 3,000 plus people, but also with companies that are 50 people that are growing. And the idea is to be able to leverage a partner that is scalable.
Yeah.
And that's kind of how we've tried to position ourselves in the market. And that's also how we think about our technology, how we think about partnering with companies, is to be able to give them a resource that can run and build and grow this service that they want. Because we don't think about food and beverage as culture. We think of it as something, as a tool to augment culture.
Yeah.
Right? So, like, we think of it as an opportunity for us to be able to create connections within your office space. But the culture that you have is, you know, based on your values. It's based on your people that are there. And we are here as a tool, as a resource to be able to help augment that as an offering that you're giving to a company.
So let's talk about the tech part. I want to get into the experience that I am going to have once we get ourselves over 50 employees and we start working with Crafty.
Love it.
Walk me through it, and as close to that line of unfair advantage secret sauce as you can get.
Yeah.
Show me how you guys make this different for everybody else.
Totally. So you as a, you know, let's say that you are an office manager, you know, but prior to working with Crafty, you are generally working with a different company for your alcohol services. You're working with a different company for coffee, for snacks, for beverages, for produce. And then also, generally, it's pretty difficult to be able to understand what your budget is, what you're spending on a per person basis, and how you're managing that on a day-to-day basis.
Well, yeah, you're not in the business of managing. You are. I'm not in the business of managing waste. I don't know what is going on. And this is, so I'm putting the pause button on for 1 second. We're going to go right back to this. This is a prelude for those of you who are still listening. This is a prelude to the end of this, because we're going to dig deeper into like what you're extracting knowledge wise from like the different new business types and you know, the gig economy stuff and like how we glue people together. One of the things that I think is so unique about the food conversation and culture is, and you just hit on it, or I hit on it and you hit back on it, the waste thing. You can win all of your employees over by saying we're going to provide you with food, and in the exact same token, lose every one of them because you don't recycle or you don't manage waste. And
oh,
they're
my
like,
God, yeah.
what a shit, like they waste. There's homeless people everywhere and we're just sitting here garbage food. Like, it's just interesting. We'll get back to that, but go continue.
And actually, just really quick on that, I think it's really important for companies that are in the food and beverage space. And you know, I say this from a perspective of, we haven't been perfect, but we're working to improve it every single day.
Yep.
And I think that's something that's really important when you know think about huge folks like Compass Group and Aramark, and even, you know, more local folks, but making sure that if you're a food company, there are concerted efforts that you are making to make sure that you are being a positive contributor to the waste chain that exists.
Yep.
So, you know, for us, we partner with a composting company to be able to offer that to employees, or rather to clients, when they're in a building that doesn't offer composting services. Because, you know, it's something that we believe in. We want to make sure that, you know, we're providing this product, and if it's going to be wasted within your office space, one, we want to be able to track that it was wasted through inventory management and knowing that, okay, you actually didn't consume all of this. What were the reasons that you didn't consume all of this? So next time we fulfill this product, let's actually fulfill less so you don't actually waste any product. So that's one part of it. But the second is, when it is wasted, knowing that this is going to, you know, an earthworm farm that is south of Chicago. And it's going back into that circular economy that we want it to be a part of. So when I think about what we want to do also is be really good stewards of the economy. We want to be really good stewards of the environment. We want to be really good stewards to our employees. So, you know, you think about, you know, oftentimes you think about the triple bottom line. You know, that's a phrase that has been used, you know, time and time and time again. But really, when you break it down, like, a lot of it is, how do you be a really good employer? Right, like, how do you make sure that you're paying people in the right way? You are living to your values, and then for us, especially for folks that, you know, you talk to in the food space, how do you make sure that what we're doing is directly related to the environment? So how do we make sure that we're being good stewards to the environment?
No, so if you bring up a great point, I think the part of it that's interesting from my standpoint is like, okay, so if I look at your business and I look at like how you're working with all of these different companies, and you're sort of helping them facilitate a restaurant internally, basically, right?
In many ways, yeah, totally.
So, like, I step back and I look at your business model, I'm just like, you have all the upside, what upside there is in the restaurant industry without any of the downside. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, conceptually, yeah, yeah. Like, obviously there's problems and stuff, but, like, all of these offices are essentially a 9-hour operating restaurant that have 3 rush hours, and you need to make sure that at all 3 rush hours that the whatever is the soup du jour is there with whatever needs to be there, and that you manage that flow. They pay you to do it. They pay for the food. They pay for everything.
Yeah.
And all you have to do is make sure that you keep your margins, which in our business line, what is interesting about your business to me is, like, so my partner is the founder of SMS Assist. And what I learned from him that is blew my mind away when I figured out how SMS built is they essentially bought their lines of business. They basically just said, listen, you're all going to do this. You're all going to do facilities and maintenance repairs of all these properties, right? That's going to happen. What happens if I could just buy that contract on all 3 corners of this area, and I, on my side, could figure out a way to get the margins better by having only people in the northeast corner of this town operate there and pre-buy salt for everybody and only send plumbers to this corner and that corner and this, you know, so that we're not driving across city and wasting time and fuel and carry and all this stuff. What if I could get the margin 16, 17, 20, 25% better? And then let's say I added technology to it, so it automated it. Now I get myself 20, 30, 40% margin. I can just keep that. I'm going to pay you for the contract just like you pay them, but I'm just going to make a lot more money on it. And that's what I see in your business that I think is so unique, is, like, maybe not today because you're not, I'm presumably not flush with cash, but, like, at a certain point, if you continue to excel the way you are, you have the ability to basically go to all these companies and say, listen, I'm going to take care of everything, soup to nuts, on your food, beverage, everything. And it's my job to make money on it, not yours. So I know that for me to make money, I'm going to charge you. It costs $10 a head a day for food. It's probably more than that, but, like, let's just say it's $10 a head per day for food. And I'm going to charge you $15 because it's going to be food plus operations. So you've got to figure out a way to get that down to, like, $7. And if you can do that, you're going to make money all day long. And if you get scale, you can go even crazier. And so, like, I get where you're going with this. It's a great business.
Appreciate that. Thank you. Yeah. Yeah.
So go ahead.
And you're totally right. Like, the burden of operation is on us to solve. And that's how we approach
it. Those are the best businesses because you control it. Like, the thing that I and everybody else struggles with and is a founder, and this is not just founders. This is business. This is Jamie Dimon at Chase dealing with the cryptocurrency shit. Like, this is everything. Success is predicated on being able to minimize the influence of others. Or if you have it, harness it.
Yeah.
So, like, if you can block out and be like, we're young, we've got a lot of shit we got to deal with, right? So we're just blocking, tackling, trying to get the opportunity. But at scale, the real test for crafty is to get to scale where you're like, I have figured out how to put all of my issues in a corner and I control all of the upside and all the downside, but, like, it's on you to pull the lever. And that is, like, when you see businesses that go, it's the ones that have figured out faster than the rest how to pull the levers internally and not give a shit about outside.
Yeah, no, and that's also how we approach conversations with clients too, right?
Of course,
like,
yeah.
It's all about
save you money.
How do you make sure that you are being economical and being economically competitive with what's currently out there, while still saying, hey, we're going to provide you the best client experience that you have ever experienced.
Yep.
You're going to feel like you are, you know, the client side to a consulting agency, because we are here to satisfy your every need, make sure that you don't have to bat an eye, and rather you have all the influence that you need on this program, but you don't have to execute anything on the day-to-day because you can trust that everything is going to be done correctly.
And here's the best part about what you just said for everybody, but for you guys. If you offer that, as you say, white gloves, I'm a huge fan of that because white gloves are really fucking cheap, actually. Like, I don't know if anyone ever pays attention, but like white gloves, and you see the people who are like serving me with white gloves, I always laugh because it's like a 50 cent, whatever, like linen glove that
Depot,
they did. It's like, it's garbage.
Pack 50,
but it makes me feel so good. And so the idea is that if you get these people to believe, these people, your customers, the valued people, to believe and you, like that this opportunity exists to make a better work experience, that you're going to have better retention, better everything, and you deliver on what you said, not only will they continue to work with you, but they will add. They will buy more. They will add for more stuff. And the add-ons are where your margins are, right? So when you go back to your suppliers and you're like, these companies that you couldn't sell this to, I got them buying it by the dozen. Your costs are going to go down because they're like, holy shit, like how's this guy... And all of a sudden you have all the, like you've got all the carts. It's, that is why I said in the beginning, it's like your business, the restaurant business without the bullshit is, that should be your slogan.
That's, I think that's our new slogan. It's amazing.
Welcome to Crafty, the restaurant business without all the bullshit. No, it's very interesting.
Thank you. And actually the point that you bring up, that's how we've grown, right? Like we started about 3.5 years ago as a craft beer keg service for corporate offices.
Yep.
Super specific.
So that's where you were at. When I met you, you were just turning away from that.
Yes.
If I'm not mistaken.
Because you were
like the supplier of that for WeWork. But like I remember talking to you there. I actually now vividly remember this conversation where you're like, the next evolution is this. And to see you guys back here and doing it is awesome.
Thank you. Appreciate it. And like, you know, huge shout out to all of the clients that we have that have taken that risk with us.
Yep.
Right? Like they said, hey, you guys are doing great on this craft beer keg thing. Can you also do other things? Can you do cold brew and kombucha on tap? Can you do hot coffee and machines? Can you do all of our snacks? Can you run our inventory management? Can you have people on site to be able to stock everything and do inventory? And, you know, it's a shout out to them and it's a testament to them that have fueled the growth of our business. And like that client loyalty. And I think like the idea of building with clients is what's allowed us to be here. And I think it's something that like is so true to our values as a company. And how we hope to grow is, you know, with clients and like with that building relationships with them.
So new website just launched, right?
Yes.
Where's that at?
Craftydelivers.com.
All right. And then you guys are opening an office in San Francisco.
We are. In about 2 months, we will be going live with our operations in San Francisco.
Other than the obvious, why San Francisco versus other cities? I'm just curious. This is like for my own personal. This is my own nerdery.
No. It's a great question. Because our thought process has evolved a lot as we've thought about expansion. You know, the baseline reason is we've had clients ask us to go out there. Which
good
is,
reason.
Yeah. The best reason.
Don't go anywhere where you're not paid to go. That's like, I don't like, there's all this struggle porn. We laugh about this all the time. We have these like quotes and we put the memes up and you're going to be a meme by the end of the, by next week, John will have made you a meme. But what is like at its foundational point, it's like, don't do shit people aren't going to pay you for. Like
totally.
Boom.
Totally.
Done.
It's like, I'm not going to move to another city. Well, actually, maybe I would. I'm going to say, I'm not going to move to another city unless I have a job there. But I totally would move to another city if I didn't have a job there.
But like that's because you would create one. Like you could, this is the interesting part about your business is that there is really no market. Like I always look at this like the harder to make the pitch, right? So like in San Francisco, this should sell itself. There are other people who could push back and say, we already have our culture. We already have people established. So like you're probably in a crowded space, maybe. But if you have customers who are asking for it, you're already in. Then you just got to excel from there. You could go to other cities that have a lot more opportunity. You look at Boston and Philadelphia and DC, and there's like fragmentation, but like there's a spot for you.
Yeah.
Probably very attractive, but you don't have customers there. So you got to spend some marketing to get in, which you start San Francisco and move forward with revenue positive. But then you look at other cities that are like struggling, that don't have a tech community, and you could literally, you're selling the same service, providing the same service, but you're actually selling them on like fixing this like shithole that they work in.
Yeah, and that's the goal, right? Like for us to be able to come in and actually say, hey, we're going to do this in a way that makes everyone's life easier.
Yep.
And when we think about other markets,
you have an unlimited marketplace. I mean, obviously you know this, but like your TAM is insane.
Thank you. Yeah.
People like we talked about this. I mentioned Ricky before in the show, but I'll do it again. We talked about the real estate space and SMS. What attracted me to those guys is that every, for as long as there's a building with people in it, there's going to be a need for a person to provide them with maintenance facilities. As long as there's human beings floating around stacked 65 floors high, somebody's got to feed them.
Totally.
And it's going to be crafty.
And that's the goal. That's the goal. And when we think about other markets too, you know, we've been lucky enough to be able to work with folks that have footprints across the U.S. So if we're working with a client that's here, but their national headquarters is actually in SF, or their national headquarters is in Boston, it makes the conversation a lot easier when we're like, hey, we're thinking about this other market. You know, would you be open to working with us? Or they are sometimes like, hey, there's no one in DC.
Yep.
Can you come out to DC and work with us there?
Which is it's just like the best ever, right? I mean, like in truth, I'm sure that there's a lot of work to be done. But like once, so you've got Chicago, you got it down. Once you get San Francisco and you figure out how to manage both San Francisco and Chicago and then San Francisco on its own, I think at that point the replication becomes very viewable. And it's like there really is no place we can't market. And like as long as the client is big enough individually or a pack of them, you may never need to go to a new market until it could be 3 years before you need to go to another market on your own volition. Like where you're like, we got to go here. Like we got to go to Nashville. Like
totally.
It could just be client-based only, which is like, again, you guys are you opening a round for investment is my question. That's what I'm asking. I want to get one more question out of you before we do a little startup showcase action, which is actually going to be very interesting because it's in your space tangentially.
Yeah.
In multiple versions, you as a minority founder and the whole deal. So that'll be an interesting piece. But you have a unique vantage point for what I think is the most challenging hiring time ever. There's obviously the talent thing, which is a race against talent shortages, and that's a whole different thing. But like the Gen X, Gen Y, millennial combo question to me is I know that people are like overblowing it, but like it's real. Like the millennial and is it Gen X is the next one, right? Or is it Gen Y? I can't remember. Gen Xers,
Gen X.
Anyway, nobody. Everyone's
like
looking
Gen
on.
X.
All right, Gen X. X is before X is before millennial. So what is Davis? Does anyone know what is a 23-year-old? Gen Z.
I think that's Gen.
Oh, Gen Z.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Gen I'm
like,
Z,
okay,
yeah.
Gen. Okay, so let's go with the, like. So X, me, millennial. How old are you?
27.
You.
Yeah.
And Gen Z. So when you look at these people, like, I'm a go-getter attack, but the foods, it doesn't matter to me. Don't care. Like I would prefer it, but like it's not going to impact whether or not I want bucks. Like that's what I want.
Yeah.
Millennial wants like anything that can help them, and they seem to not be the most aggressive pursuer of information. They tend to just kind of sit back and wait. They're like digital native, but they're kind of a lazy digital native. And Gen Z is like aggressive as shit. Like they're like, feed me fuel so I can go out and like, I didn't even listen to the whole question. I just like went out and started looking. And you're like, what the fuck? What are you doing? You have this unique spot where you get to see like what attracts them and like how to keep them. Like what are the things, what are some of the key takeaways you've taken in this experience?
Totally. So I think there are a couple things. One is, and I'll just do two high level things right now. So one is, once you provide these services, you need to keep these services.
Yep. Oh, yeah.
So we did a study with Kellogg, and you know, it could be...
Are you a Northwestern guy?
Yeah, Northwestern.
Go Cats.
Are you Northwestern
as
well?
Yeah, of course.
But
times two. This whole room is except for this one here that, despite the purple bun, is actually go blue. But anyway, I digress.
So actually, me and my three co-founders all from Northwestern.
Boom.
And actually, a lot of our team is from Northwestern as well. But... So I think the first thing, we did the study with Kellogg to understand, you know, what is the state of like perks in the workplace, the state of food and beverage in the workplace. And one of the key takeaways was, once you offer it, you can't take it back.
Yeah.
You can't remove it, because the morale hit that it has on your office employees is huge. But the second thing is that it is such a low cost value add item in your space that really brings people together and has very positive externalities for your office space.
Yeah.
Because when you think about the cost of $5 per person per day, $8 per person per day, $10 per person per day, or whatever it is in your office space, it's not that much. And it's also something that's highly scalable. And what we try and do when we work with scaling companies is actually sit down with their director of finance or sit down with their finance department and think about what is the reporting structure that you need in your dashboard? What are the things that you want to be able to understand as you're scaling your business so you can actually put this in as a line item projection in your costs? Because it is a super projectable cost item for you.
Yep.
The second thing that we've started thinking about, the second thing that we've recognized is that this perk is something that is really following more of a larger trend, which is the idea of work-life integration, right? Like, I'm sure people have come on the show to talk about, you know, the difference between work-life balance and work-life integration.
Yep.
So I started my career, me and one of my partners actually started our careers at McKinsey. And when you join, one of the big things that they talk about is work-life balance. Do you have it? No, not really.
That means you do 100 hour a week. Here you go.
But that was the big theme, you know, 5-6 years ago. As time has gone on, you're seeing that people, you know, the millennials, the Gen Zers, don't really care a whole lot about work-life balance, but more care about the idea of work-life integration.
Yes.
What's fulfilling
to them?
I totally
believe that.
Yeah. Yeah. What's fulfilling to them is something that's entirely different. It's not necessarily the dollars, but it's the experience that they're trying to build.
I actually, to pile on this, and then we're going to cut to the showcase part. I look at the, use myself also, but like I don't want to judge people in their performance and stuff, but like, I just want to say, I find that the A players tend to have a very difficult time turning the light switch on and off. They have a very difficult time showing up totally unplugged and then plugging in and go like, and then they plug out and they unplug. Everything is sort of weaved together. And like the people on our team that are like that, like I find for me, if I can build a coffee meeting, I'm going to have coffee in the morning anyway. I'm going to get off the train, and between the train and the office, I'm going to have coffee. If I can stop and meet someone for a cup of coffee and knock a meeting out, I'd like to do that. I have to go to a drinking event basically every week, which makes me more or less an alcoholic. But if I can, I enjoy going out and having drinks. If I could pack that into and be friends with some people I work with and bring my wife and we can go have dinner together, like I want to roll it into it. It makes it easier because that way in your life, your fluidity, you're not like breaking it off. And I think you're dead on with that. And to your point, like that's what you guys provide, is that integration. It's not, all right, you have 1 hour, the clock is ticking, get the hell out of here and then hustle back.
Yep.
It's like, no, you can snack here, put it in the fridge, come back, finish, like whatever.
Yeah, because the fluidity between life and work is something that is becoming greater and greater.
Yep.
And us as workplaces, and this is coming from the employer side of this, you know, we as an employer want to be able to create an environment where people feel comfortable.
Yeah.
Because that's where the greatest ideation happens. That's where the greatest collaboration happens, is when you don't just see your coworker as this person that is, you know, going to be giving me peer feedback at the end of my review.
Yeah.
It's someone that really genuinely cares about me and knows me, and we're able to get into a flow and we're collaborating.
It also helps not just for hiring for the purposes that are obvious, but for the culture fit. Instead of creating this contrived culture, I can just say, like, we're all pretty lax here. So like, if you don't fit in, it's going to be really obvious really quickly and you're probably going to be gone. If you do fit in, this is going to be great. But more importantly, we're in a world that is going to continue to become more of a gig economy, and people will be here some days and not others, and more time.
Yeah.
And the easier, the more free flowing, you know, our management style is and our culture is, the easier it is to drop new people in as needed. And I think that this facilitates that in a really, you know, they say, I mean, this is no joke. We'll end on this. That most of the most important decisions globally, business or political, take place over breaking bread. So if you are a business and you can offer the ability for your people to come together, make peace when they have an argument, meet new people, facilitate things outside of the office or inside of the office, good or bad, some things that may or may not be okay for HR, but happen nonetheless, should happen at the lunch table where we have food. So like, why would you miss out on what is probably the most common place that people conversate
entirely?
Boom, we got this done. We got it. So all right, so we're going to jump into the startup showcase here. Tom, if you could kick us off with Fretch, which in case you are unfamiliar of listening, if you don't listen to this, we have the Saturday show every Saturday from 1 to 2 on WGN Radio. You can go on your smart speakers and just do that, and listen to the shows live and call in and actually invest in the companies there. But then we take the best ones, we move them here in the podcast. So you should definitely check that out. In order to invest in Fretch and the next company and every company that comes through, go to republic.co/register, hook up your credit card, and spend all of your savings immediately because it's worth it. Anyway, take it away.
Hi, my name is Naresh. I run a company called Fretch in New York. So picture a 10-pound bag of rice. If you're South Asian like me, that 10-pound bag of rice, along with 100 other spices and condiments, is as essential as milk and eggs to me. But you can't really get this bag of rice in your neighborhood grocery stores. So this problem of high dependence on ethnic food, yet poor access, is one that's shared by many, many ethnicities, whether you're Indian or you're Chinese or Filipino or you're Middle Eastern or you're South American. This is a problem that's shared across the board. And we're talking about 25% of the U.S. population, or 81 million diverse people buying ethnic groceries worth over $100 billion every year. Fretch delivers ethnic groceries right to your doorstep. We've delivered over 25,000 orders so far, and we're growing organically. We're doing over $1 million in annual revenue run rate right now, and we're highly scalable. And last bit, if I could add, is that we're profitable.
That's a great bit to end on. We're profitable. I like that. To give people kind of a real quick highlight, if you haven't seen it, you can invest for as minimal as $100 on republic.co/fretch, F-R-E-T-C-H. They've got about 70 days left, 30 investors, $20,000 raised. You know, he pretty much said everything else. What caught me in the interview I had with him was the market size. 25% of the U.S. population identifies with the ethnic community, but ethnic grocery stores are so few and far between that they actually represent 2% of sales.
Wow.
So if he picked up even a portion of that and connected the dots, that's $1 billion there. And that's not me playing like the projector meter. That's literally like, if I live in Schaumburg and let's say I'm Chinese and I only want like fresh seafood and like actual Chinese food. There's no way to get there.
Yeah.
So like the market potential there is huge. What are your thoughts on this from a multitude of spots?
Yeah, totally. So I guess the first question is like, you know, is this only raw ingredients or is this also prepared foods?
A little bit of both. So what he's doing is connecting the dots on all of the, so like, basically, like I said, like Chinatown. So like I used to have a Asia supermarket on Four Corners of Gulf Road in Schaumburg, and they have everything from prepared. It's just like a Mariano's. It's just Asian supermarket.
Like, I mean, this sounds like a dream.
Yeah.
It sounds awesome.
I mean, you go to Italian Village or any of these places, like it's all mom and pop shops, and they only get foot traffic.
Yep. Yeah, and you know, I think about I live in East Lakeview. Yep. I live right next to a Mariano's, which was one of the greatest life decisions I've ever made. But the one thing that I miss out on, you know, I still have to go up to Devon to have any type of desi food.
Yep.
Or I have to like, you know, hit up one of the aunties at where I go to prayers and be like, hey, can I get some food?
Which that means you have to talk to them, which is like, the whole other thing.
And one of the things that I've found is that, you know, it is a pain to be able to get the ingredients that I want, to be able to get the type of food that I want. So like me as a user, you know, taking the user perspective for a moment here, this is awesome. This is really interesting. Like I would be curious on like, you know, what pricing looks like. Yep. And that kind of, you know, segues more into the investor hat here of, you know, what do the unit economics of something like this look like?
Yeah.
You know, him mentioning that he's already profitable is awesome. The fact that, you know, if he's profitable, I'm assuming, you know, he's contribution margin positive.
I'll throw you a couple unit economic pieces here. 25,000 orders delivered to 5,000 unique customers, $1.1 million in annual revenue from that, 70.2% repeat customer rate. There's your month-over-month cash flow positive. I mean, as far as unit economics to me, that's all that really matters is it tells you that there's a need. 70% of people did it once and then did it again. 25,000 people used it.
That's like, this
in a year, in an opening year.
It's incredible. And like for me, it's like, how do you just fuel this guy's sales, right? Like, how do you just get him in front of more and more and more people? Because the market size here is humongous.
I told him it's first mover. He wanted to go different directions and stuff. Obviously, it's his company. But I was like, you put Instacart, Instacart's in trouble from the Amazon deals. You put yourself in a position to be an acquisition target of anyone competing against that trouble or just Amazon in general or Whole Foods, whatever, because nobody else is gonna, like, it's up to you to connect the dots. None of those mom and pop shops are gonna actually, like, call each other and facilitate any organized. So, like, if you wrote out every one of them and you just go, will you let us put a fulfillment iPad here, mm-hmm. and have someone just come here and pick it up? Like, will you do, if you'll do that, I will bring you money. Like,
without a doubt. And I think one of the great things about this business model, about this individual, is the fact that it's not, he's not stressing on the same commodity that Instacart's stressing on. And, you know, no flack on Instacart, yep. or DoorDash or any of them. But they're all selling the same thing.
Correct.
Right? Versus this is actually selling something that is you know, a literal commodity,
yeah.
but not a commoditized resource. And, like, you know, it is something that also touches on an interesting level of sentimentality for a lot of people.
Oh, my God, yeah. Where, that's the stickiness.
Which is incredible. Like, I'm not buying a bag of Cheetos from this. I'm buying my mom's Kheer.
Yep.
It's just, you know, not made by my mom. And I think that that gets this to be really, really interesting. The second point, and the second question that I would have for him is, you know, what does it take to set up a new market?
Yeah.
What is the process of setting up a new market? How long does it take? What are the resources that you need? And how do you go about making sure that you're fulfilling at the same service level that you were in your home market? And that's the big question that we get.
Yeah, I think, you know, I can't speak for about that one. I would say, if I had to guess, the only nice thing I would say is it's been done with the Instacarts and the DoorDash. Yeah. So, like, there is a blueprint to success. It's whether or not he manages it properly. But to look at 25% of the population is a potential market. Like, and who doesn't love a fragmented market? Like, as an entrepreneur, this is like heaven.
And to be able to come in with a truly unique service here is, I think, exceptional.
Yeah, very cool. Ishan, this was amazing. We had a great show, obviously.
Thank you for having me.
No, truly. Of course. Thank you. This is like one of the better ones. It's like rare. We get, like, into the investor part, and then, like, no one nerds out, and we got to, like, play like three little positions here in one show. So I really appreciate you coming on. Where do people go to learn more, one more time, about Crafty?
Craftydelivers.com.
Very cool. Awesome. Well, you can learn more about upcoming Technori events, investment opportunities. Check out the blog at technori.com. Download the podcast on Spotify, Apple, wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on social at Technori, or you can follow me at Katoon. Boom. That's a wrap.